I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and calling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a part of life. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the park that keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. When you run down my country, man, you walking on the fighting side of me.
When you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and of course, all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, it just gets better and better. Our terrorist attack up here in Canada on the weekend. This is something we've got to get across to all members of Parliament. It's on you. No, I'm not one of those people who tries to explain other problems by saying it's all society's fault or it's never the perpetrator's fault. Yes, it is the perpetrator's fault. Of course it is. One of our wonderful refugees, yeah. He got in because the system is broken. He obviously hates Canada, and at least 2 years ago that came to the attention of federal authorities that there's a problem with this guy. He has expressed radical views, whatever those are, and still, nothing was done about it. I found it very, very interesting today, an article in the National Post. What options did police have in 2015 when they were tipped off that Sharif, that's the guy's name, was Abdullahi Hassan Sharif, that he was espousing extremist views. Canadian authorities have increasingly used peace bonds to restrain people who are thought to be terrorist sympathizers, but who haven't done enough to justify an arrest. In these cases, a judge can issue a court order that imposes conditions such as restrictions on movements or a ban on computers or on using computers. In July 2015, anti-terror legislation took effect and lowered the threshold required to get a peace bond. Instead of needing reasonable grounds for believing someone will commit a terrorist act, they instead needed reasonable grounds only that they may commit a terrorist act. It's not clear whether that lower threshold was in place when police investigated Sharif. Neither the RCMP nor the Office of Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale, he's always monitoring a situation, which means sitting on his butt and doing nothing. Neither of them will say when in 2015 that the investigation occurred or under what legal regime. keep us in the dark, don't tell us anything. But even if the investigation took place under the old rules, the police could have reopened it when the new rules kicked in. Well, that would mean they'd have to be interested. However, the RCMP Assistant Commissioner Martin DeGrand has said that Sharif and others were extensively interviewed at the time. At the end of that exhaustive investigation, there was insufficient evidence to pursue terrorism charges or a peace bond. Well, I have another idea. What was he even doing in this country? I mean, that's the problem. What are these people from terrorist-producing countries, young males, what are they doing in this country? That is the question that we must ask relentlessly. What are they doing in my country? If Sharif held extremist views, how was he able to obtain refugee status? Good question. Sharif, a Somali, arrived at a Canadian border crossing in 2012 and claimed asylum, according to Goodale. You see? He was safe in the United States. He should have been turned back. Under third safe country provisions, if somebody comes to Canada or the United States, they must make a refugee claim in the country they first come to. Not asylum shop. Well, when Sharif showed up at the border in 2012, what should have been done? Don't unpack, Abdullahi. You're going back to the States. You're their problem. Later that year, in 2012, the Immigration and Refugee Board granted him convention refugee status in Canada, which someone gets if they're unable to return to their home country because of a well-founded fear of persecution. Well, why would he have a well-founded fear of persecution? Don't know. Don't tell us. So he's ours, even though he came to the country illegally. The Safe Third Country Agreement between Canada and the United States means a refugee claimant normally needs to make his claim in the country in which he's first arrived. However, there are exceptions for which Sharif may have qualified, such as having family members in one of the countries. Oh, so he may have had some family members here. Why should that be an exception? Why should that be an exception? He should have been made to go back to the United States. On Tuesday, Vice News first reported that Sharif was ordered to be deported back to Somalia by a U.S. immigration judge in 2011. U.S. officials say he had no known criminal history when the order was made. A Canadian government spokesman declined to confirm whether it's the same Sharif, but said that being denied refugee status in the U.S. does not necessarily mean that he'd be not denied in Canada. Oh no, where the soft touch had the easy, good time had by one and all. Goodale, he's the Minister of Public Safety, has insisted that the refugee process functioned properly in 2012, and any information that would have flagged Sharif as a terrorist sympathizer, or there simply wasn't any such information. Okay, well now there is. Boot him out. Well, now he's committed a crime. The procedures that are in place our procedures that place a very high opinion. Opinion on public safety and security. Oh yeah, right. We can see that it was working very well. He said officials check Canadian and international records to ensure that there is no history of criminal activity on immigration. There's no history of criminal activity or immigration violations. Well, you know, this beyond belief. Can Sharif be removed from the country as a security threat? Currently, Sharif has only refugee status and has not been granted permanent residency, which is a separate process for someone who applies for asylum. Canada has a process to deport a convention refugee deemed a security threat, but it requires a danger opinion signed off on by a senior immigration official. Canada generally does not deport people back to a country where they risk facing torture or other serious persecution. It shouldn't matter in this case. He is a security threat to Canada. He is a danger. He showed his utter contempt for us by trying to kill a police officer and mow down with a hijacked U-Haul van pedestrians in downtown Edmonton. There's no real indication he's faced torture in Somalia, but that becomes his grief. We don't need him. We don't want him, and we shouldn't have to have him. Deport him after he served whatever sentence he's going to get for Saturday's terror attacks. It all comes down to will. Is there a will to protect Canada and Canadians? Not just a bit of sloganeering, but a will. What will they do, these politicians? It remains to be seen. But this should be put to them, and put to them forcefully. It's on them, on the politicians. They have done this. This is the mess, the convoluted refugee and immigration mess that they have developed. Well, it has to be reformed. In fact, probably one of the best reforms possible would be to simply cut off all immigration and refugee intake until such time as we have full employment. We don't need any of them. There is no room. We are filled up. That's what we, and there may be no end of sad sack stories and worthy causes and so on, but it should be up to neighboring countries, fellow Muslim countries, to take these people, not us. How does it become our responsibility? Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. There is a madness, a lunacy, a Red Guard insanity afoot of political correctness. Here's a story by Bruce Pardee. He's a professor of law at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. And this is about the latest bumptious meddling by the Law Society of Upper Canada, or that's the province of Ontario. They now want lawyers to send in a personal statement of principles. Cynical guys like me would say, make money! But okay. Let's dress the old whore up with a fright wig and some rouge and some bright red lipstick and pretend she's a beauty. Okay, a statement of principles. Unfortunately, it's a bit more sinister than that. The statement of principles is not just, well, what are you all about, Alfie? It's you must commit to this. We want you to put it in writing. Now, that is more dangerous. Every lawyer gets emails from the Law Society of Upper Canada, says Bruce Pardee, a professor. Reminders to file reports, pay fees, or use assistance programs to cut back on the booze. what a bunch of meddling nannies. But a recent message almost made me choke on my sandwich. New obligations for 2017. was its subject line. Actions you need to take. All lawyers, it said, must prepare and submit a personal statement of principles attesting that we value and promote equality, diversity, and inclusion. Now that's not that we recognize, but that we value. Oh, I don't value diversity. I think equality's a crock. Now, if you mean equality before the law, yes, I agree with that. If you mean equality in the eyes of God, well, I hope so, but I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to be a smart aleck, but I haven't received a recent phone call from God telling me how he thinks. So what exactly would it mean? But we're supposed to not only value, but promote diversity. Why would I want to promote chaos? Okay, well, the professor goes on to say, according to the advisory, quote, the intention of the statement of principles is to demonstrate a personal valuing of equality, diversity, and inclusion with respect to the employment of others, or in professional dealings with other licensees, or any other person. What does that mean? That you value diversity in terms of employment. That is, your receptionist or secretary or legal assistant. I like to value diversity. I would like to be like people who are compatible with me culturally, socially, and so on. In terms of professional dealings with other licensees, how would you value diversity and inclusion? You should behave professionally and honorably with them, regardless of background. I agree with that. But why would you needlessly go out of your way to seek out, let's say, Chinese lawyers? I want to be inclusive. Why not? I will deal with whoever I must deal with in professional dealings. My first instinct, writes Bruce Pardee, was to check my passport. Was I still in Canada, or had someone whisked me away to North Korea, where people must say what officials want to hear? Forced speech, and this is really very important, forced speech is the most egregious violation of freedom of expression, protected by Section 2B of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. In free countries, law governs actions rather than expressions of beliefs. People can be required to obey the speed limit and pay taxes, but they may not be compelled to declare that speed limits are properly set or the taxes are a good thing. That's an important distinction. The law may require you to do something. It does not take away your right to criticize the law. And, you know, theoretically speaking, yes, speed limit is 60 miles an hour, or up here on the Dominion of Canada, where we've adopted the foreign system, it's 100 kilometers an hour. I may be legally required to obey that speed limit, but I am not required to say, I think it's right. In fact, I wish they'd lower it. I mean, I can say that the speed limit is set artificially low, or that there should be no speed limits at all. But to be a driver means to be an adult, and as an adult, you must be in control of your vehicle at all times. You should decide. Bruce Pardee continues. The Supreme Court of Canada has said that forcing someone to express opinions they do not have is totalitarian, and as such is alien to the tradition of free nations like Canada, even for the repression of the most serious crimes. And I don't always agree with the Supreme Court, but that certainly makes a lot of sense. You might be enjoined not to do certain things, but you cannot be forced to say certain things that you don't believe. Like, I believe in equity, inclusion, and diversity. I don't believe in diversity. I think it's a dangerous crock, and diversity is a code word for anti-white. Equity, well, I'm not sure that I know what it means, except an attempt to make everybody the same. I mean, is that what it means? And he goes on to say, the email might as well have been announced that the Thought Police had taken over the Law Society of Upper Canada, soon to drop its historical moniker and become known as the Law Society of Ontario. Yes, the rampage on tradition continues. In 2012, IP, that's the Law Society of Upper Canada, created a working group to investigate systemic racism in the legal profession. In 2016, the working group reported, wait for it, that there's systemic racism in the legal profession. Is there any doubt about that? that was the foregone conclusion of this cultural Marxist endeavor. It's doubtful whether the data upon which the report ruled actually supports the conclusion, but that is not the point of this column. The Law Society accepted its recommendations for action, three of which are being implemented this year. One of them is the requirement for personal statements of principles, which require not just compliance with the law, but concurrence. So not just compliance with the law, which might be reasonable, but concurrence, where you are being forced to say that I agree with the, and you know what diversity is. It's basically an effort to replace the white race. That's what diversity is. That is what it means at the bottom. That's what it's all about. Well, I can't agree with that. At the core of free speech is the liberty to criticize the content of the law. Quote, however admirable the objectives and provisions of the law may be, said the Supreme Court ruled, no one is obliged to approve of them. Anyone may criticize them and seek to have them amended or repealed, though complying with them so long as they are in effect. So just because there's a law does not mean that you have to agree with it. You may have to comply with it legally, but you don't have to state that you agree with it. And that's very important. If you have to have a personal statement of personal principles in which you pledge yourself to promote, not just to accept, but to promote diversity, inclusion, and equity, you're being forced to say something you don't believe. And that is extremely dangerous. That is really Maoism. For no one is this more important, writes Bruce Pardee, than lawyers, who are the last line of defense against authoritarian orthodoxy. Had this requirement been imposed upon another of the government professions, nurses, say, or engineers, they would hire a lawyer to protect their rights to think and speak for themselves. This time, it is the lawyers themselves whose ability to argue about the law's propriety is threatened. The contours of anti-discrimination laws have long been the subject of debate within the legal circles. For example, Richard Epstein, a prominent American legal scholar in his 1992 book, Forbidden Grounds, The Case Against Employment Discrimination Laws, argued for the repeal of such laws on the ground that they, quote, set one group against another, impose limits on freedom of choice, unleash bureaucratic excesses, mandate inefficient employment practices, and cause far more individual discrimination than they prevent. Whether Epstein is right or wrong is part of the debate. The Law Society's new requirements effectively prohibits Ontario lawyers from engaging in that debate. Instead, they must betray their integrity and submit a statement of principles that professes values that they may not hold. And certainly, if I don't hold them. This policy crosses a line that should not be crossed. It's not enough that we obey. Now we must agree and actively promote. The late Alan Borvoit, former general counsel of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, said that the greatest threat to liberty is not from without, but from within. The source of the most insidious peril, he said, at a speech at Queen's University about 10 years ago, is not evil wrongdoers seeking to do harm, but parochial bureaucrats seeking to do good. I suspect Borvoit would be shocked that his warning would apply so acutely to the governing body of the legal profession. The Law Society does not say how it will punish lawyers who do not comply. It states only, and ominously, that they will be advised of their obligations in writing. Well, we're going to send you a formal letter, and if you ignore it, well, who knows what the or else would be. Perhaps compelling speech upon penalty of actual sanctions would be unconstitutional. How should lawyers respond? They have a number of choices. They could conform. They might that might suggest lawyers are unable or unwilling to defend themselves. They might decline. That might determine whether elected benchers, these are like the board of directors of the Law Society of Upper Canada, elected benchers will actually represent them, or they could just submit a copy of this column.
Actually, not a bad idea, in my opinion. Part of the insanity of today's politically correct world in Canada is the absolute fetishism about Native people. There's a firm ideology that the Indians were badly abused, were ripped off, were culturally genocided, although there are more of them in Canada today than there ever were in colonial times. It's obviously not a very effective genocide program. White society is all guilty. A very bad narrative. Now, it's one thing for natives to have this narrative. They can tell their history any way they like, accurate or inaccurate. However, for mainstream establishment to buy into it, very, very dangerous, because it undermines the very legitimacy of our institutions. School takes down 44-year-old totem pole. An Ontario elementary school removed a decades-old totem pole from outside its front entrance on Friday after discovering that it was built without Indigenous input. So the local Indians, if indeed there are any local Indians, didn't get a chance to have a say. Well, why should they? Was it their money? Grade 6 students in Summit View Public School in Stouffville, Ontario, that's north and east of Toronto, carved the totem pole in 1973. Whoa, boy, those bad kids. Former teacher Bernardine Mumford, who started the project, told the Stouffville Sun Tribune it was part of a Canadian history exercise that focused on the great harm done to Indigenous peoples. So even in those days, it was politically correct. It was a way of honoring the Indian people and so on. One may quibble, and rightly so. There weren't any totem poles in Ontario. They come from West Coast Indians, but okay. Quote, it bothered me that there was an implication it was racist, she told the paper. After community-based concerns emerged about the structure, the York Region District Board decided it amounted to cultural appropriation. Now, after community-based concerns, that's a quote from the York Regional School Board. We find out a little later in the article that's one parent. One parent bitched about it, and down goes the totem pole. Well, it shows that we are suffering. We're almost terminally ill from minorityitis. The majority letting itself be bossed around by maybe not even minorities, maybe just one sorehead who can claim, I'm a native people. Well, okay, whatever. When initially constructed with positive intentions, the board said in a letter to parents this week, our understanding of how cultural appropriation affects our learning environment has developed significantly. Well, it's hard to know what that even means. Bureaucratic gobbledygook. And I used to live in the belly of the beast. I was an English instructor for 25 years. educational bureaucracies is often impenetrable. I mean, let's try that one more time. While initially constructed with positive intentions, okay, well, that much I think we can agree with. Our understanding of how cultural appropriation affects our learning environments has developed significantly. Well, white students carved a totem pole. Should the only people who could have carved a totem pole have been Native Indians? I'll take that one step further. We didn't have totem poles in Ontario, the Indian tribes here didn't. Could the only people who could be able to carve a totem pole be a West Coast Indian? But you can see the insanity. This was not put forth as a historical artifact. This was just a project that the kids at that elementary school did with good intentions. Quote, the totem pole was created without consultation or involvement of members of Indigenous nations, including members of the Indigenous nations of the West Coast, for which the totem pole is unique. That may indeed be true. And how exactly was a lowly elementary school teacher supposed to consult the Indigenous people, that's the Indians, on the West Coast? She's in Stouffville, Ontario, like 2,000 plus miles away, in the days before the internet. Is this really fair? In deciding what to do, the board consulted with representatives from the Chippewa of Georgina Island, a local First Nation, that's Indian, who agreed the totem pole has to come down. Yeah, down the totem pole. We'll tell you the result. There won't be any recognition of Indians at that school. Oh, a band counselor Lori Hoag said she told the board officials that since getting the structure was getting old and rickety and had evidently offended a parent, it was best to just get rid of it. It offended a parent, one parent. Well, if I saw a picture of that communist terrorist Nelson Mandela in a school, I'd be offended. You think they would take it down for me? You do? Probably not. Even the leader, chief didn't see a huge insult in it. She said, at that time, there was less awareness of what appropriation was, Hope said. The First Nation felt it was probably not done with any ill intent. That's why we're not jumping up and down with our arms in the air. Everyone's just trying to do the right thing. The board disposed of the totem pole Friday after school ended. Yeah, snuck in there and I guess hacked it down or dragged it away. A move it hoped would give a renewed beginning for our current students and staff to learn about and from members of our Indigenous nations, according to the press release. The Director of Education, Drew McNaughton, said reaction to the board's decision is being mixed. Listen, I think we're engaged in some significant learning since the totem pole went up, McNaughton said. The one big thing for me is around the spaces that we're creating in our schools. The board said the school is planning to work with the Chippewas of Georgina Island to potentially come up with something to put in the totem pole's place. excuse me if I find this just incredibly, incredibly repressive and precious. Well, let's have some real He-Man music. Let's have something that reflects, I think, a little bit better the spirit of white people, not always on their knees, groveling and apologizing and disowning what was done by previous generation. This really is a problem. This endless apologizing. There's nothing to apologize for. I'm going to play a couple of tunes by Rebel Sun. Rebel Sun is a dynamic singer. Some of his lyrics can be a little on the raw side. The two songs I'm going to play tonight, I hope, are not on the raw side. Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee, Confederate Son. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
Thank you. house. I got a glimpse of a bearded man polishing his sword. Well, I saw Robert E. Lee outside sitting on the porch. I pulled up in the yard and saw a cotton field out back. He invited me to sit with him and share a fifth of Jack. He had crisscross bars and 13 stars blowing in the wind. He said, save your Confederate money, boy, cause the South will rise again. And Robert E. Lee did not like the Northerners one bit. He was a rebel as he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. We talked about his troops and the rebel infantry and those 13 southern states that live in infamy. As he took another swig of his black label whiskey, he said, that Yankee pride don't mean a damn thing to me. He spoke about his men and how they always fought so brave and how they wove their sacred flag though many lives they gave. He struggled to gain independence for his southern ground. He stood up for his cause and never wants to eat back down. And Robert E. Lee did not like the Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee.
That's Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee. Great song by Rebel Sun. I'm going to play another song by him. This is a lovely ballad, and it's called Confederate Man. Rebel Sun, this is Paul Frohman, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, and how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants, and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big egg-shaped flag. She said, class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him? Well, the school bell rang and I thought as the bus carried me across town. I got out my pencil and my notebook pad, and this is what I wrote down. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate Man. Next day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk. Then she called me up in front of everyone because she said she liked mine the best. As I walked up to the head of the class, my teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. Home reading through the news just the other day, when I ran across my old teacher's name and I saw that she had passed away. With a bittersweet smile, I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath pencil words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Plus, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate Man, I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your
your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man.
Thank you.
Join me in Southern Ground. This is Paul Fron. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And that was also by Rebel Sun. And this is Paul Fron. And you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Ah, well. Talk about not welcoming diversity or not being very inclusive. In fact, typical fanatical Red Guardism. It's kind of a complicated story, but the House of Commons Committee on Status of Women is by standing orders. That is the procedure of the House of Commons to be chaired by a member of the opposition. Now, the member of the opposition who was voted on was nominated actually by her party leader was Rachel Harder. Now, she's a really pretty blonde lady, and not the favorite just for that reason of the militant buzz-cutted feminists. However, she has another sin. Rachel Harder is pro-life. Whoa, pro-life? No, they want people who are pro-death. Abortion fanatics. That's what the committee wants. Well, although her party leader appointed her, the two opposition parties, that's the Socialist NDP, or New Democratic Party, and the Liberals, found a way to sabotage it. And it really shows their fanaticism. They say they're pro-choice. No, they're pro-abortion. Both party leaders, but particularly the trust fund kid, the Liberal Party leader, Justin Trudeau, for all his blather about inclusiveness and diversity and tolerance, has decreed that no candidate or elected member of his party can oppose abortion. Any matter that involves abortion, they must uncritically support, no matter what their conscience is, no matter what their constituents say. The absolute right to exterminate a woman's unborn child is very precious to the trust fund kid. Anyway, how do the Liberals and the NDP get around it? Liberals, with the support of a New Democrat, strong-armed and unwilling conservative into chairing the House SAS Women Committee yesterday. It's not the normal procedure for a majority government to pick who gets positions reserved for the official opposition. Conservatives say the move is a sign of liberal intolerance. The SASA Women Committee chairman is, as always, a member of the official opposition, which in this case would be the Conservative Party. But last week, Liberal MPs walked out of a committee meeting to protest the nomination of Conservative MP Rachel Harder, who, after all, only has one vote on the committee. Who is also the party's status of women's critic. The dramatic move came after New Democratic critic Sheila Malcolmson raised concerns about Harder's pro-life stance and how that would affect her steering of a committee. And in this opposition, she was supported by the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, the Child Extermination Committee of Canada. Meanwhile, conservatives rallied around Harder, saying her personal views wouldn't preclude her from being able to do the job. I mean, isn't she allowed to have personal views? Well, apparently not in utterly politically correct Canada. So, this is what they did. So when the gavel came down on Tuesday, Conservative MP Karen Vecchio nominated Harder again. Liberals asked for a vote, and with Malcolmson's support, that's the NDP, knocked down the nomination. Instead, Liberal Vice Chair Chairman Pam Damoff moved Vecchio to be the chairman. Although I appreciate the nomination, I would like to back down from that nomination if possible, Vecchio said. Procedurally, that would require the consent of the committee, and she didn't get it. Liberals and NDP voted together to make her the chairman, despite her own objections, and Vecchio quickly adjourned the meeting. So she couldn't even resign as chairman because she didn't want to be chairman.
She wanted her fellow conservative, Rachel Harder. Apparently, what appealed reluctantly to the anti-life NDP and liberals was the fact that Vecchio has said she is pro-choice. Vecchio said, for Justin Trudeau to say a member of parliament is unfit to hold a procedural position because she doesn't agree with his personal position is ridiculous. It's disappointing that Justin Trudeau would act this way, and his actions demonstrate the intolerance of the Liberal Party of Canada, which claims to value diversity. And of course, that's really what this is all about. Once more, an attack on free thought and free speech. Very much under attack in Canada. I strongly urge people to be very careful when they hear words like diversity, inclusiveness, and so on. It usually doesn't mean you. If you're a nationalist, if you're a traditional Christian, it doesn't mean you. Don't confuse inclusion with having a place for you. No, that's not what it means. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me here on White Resistance Radio. com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. This show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of these are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48 Highlanders.